Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the conference call on bardoxolone methyl and Alport syndrome. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require operator assistance, please press star then zero on your touch-tone telephone. As a reminder, today's conference call is being recorded. A PDF version of this presentation is now available on the webcast. It will also be available along with an audio recording of today's webcast on Reata's website, reatapharma.com, in the Investor News section shortly after the call today. Before the company proceeds with its remarks, please note the forward-looking statements disclosure in the company's press release. The company will be making forward-looking statements on today's call. There are many factors that could cause results to differ from expectations, including those noted in the company's SEC filings. Today's statements are not guarantees of future outcomes. Please also note that any comments made on today's call speak only as of today, November 14th, 2016, and may no longer be accurate at the time of any webcast replay or transcript rereading. Following the prepared remarks, we will open up the call for questions. We ask that you please limit yourself to one question and one follow-up so that we can accommodate as many questions as possible. I would now like to turn the conference over to Vinny Gendel, Vice President of Strategy. Please go ahead.
Thanks, Candice. Hello and welcome everyone to Reata Pharmaceuticals conference call to discuss the launch of bardoxolone methyl into Alport syndrome. This is a significant development for the company, and we're grateful you've joined us for the call. I'm joined on the call today by Reata's CEO, Warren Huff, who will provide an overview of Alport syndrome and the company's development plans for this indication, and Reata's Chief Medical Officer, Dr. Colin Meyer, who will go into greater depth on the Phase 2-3 trial design and endpoints, and some relevant history for bardoxolone methyl in chronic kidney disease. And without further ado, please welcome Reata's CEO, Warren Huff.
Thanks, Vinny, and thanks to those of you joining us for this important milestone for Reata. Today, we announced that we're initiating a development program in a rare form of severe chronic kidney disease that's caused by Alport syndrome. As many of you know, Reata is focused on developing treatments for rare diseases with limited treatment options where mitochondrial dysfunction drives chronic inflammation that's central to the pathophysiology of the disease. As we'll discuss in more detail later in the call, our prior experience treating patients with chronic kidney disease caused by diabetes and recent clinical trial results reported by our development partner, Kaiwahako Kirin, led us to believe that bardoxolone methyl could be an effective treatment for patients with this severe and life-threatening disease, and that change in estimated glomerular filtration rate, or GFR, could be an appropriate endpoint for a clinical trial. We initially approached the FDA in August of this year seeking guidance on the design of a Phase 2 program in Alport syndrome. We had a very collaborative interaction with the agency, and during our Type B meeting, the FDA suggested that a single pivotal Phase 2-3 trial that demonstrates that bardoxolone methyl produces a retained estimated GFR treatment benefit versus placebo could be sufficient to register the drug for approval in Alport syndrome. The agency stated that a significant retained improvement in estimated GFR after 48 weeks of treatment and 4 weeks off drug could support accelerated approval. They added that full approval could be supported by similar data at the end of 2 years of treatment. Based on the guidance from the FDA, we've decided to initiate a Phase 2-3 study in Alport syndrome. We'll begin by enrolling an open-label Phase 2 cohort in the coming months, and we'll provide guidance on the timing of those results after the study started. The Phase 3 cohort will begin enrolling after completion of the Phase 2 study. As background, our lead drug, bardoxolone methyl, activates fundamental molecular pathways that promote the resolution of a normal, healthy inflammatory response. It's now known that mitochondria play a key role in initiating inflammation and cytokine production by switching from ATP production into what is called mitochondrial dysfunction, releasing reactive oxygen species. This activates major pro-inflammatory genes, including NF-kappa-B and the inflammasome, leading to production of cytokines like TNF, IL-1, IL-6, and many others. In many diseases, these pathways never resolve and are chronically activated, promoting fibrosis and remodeling of critical tissues and organs. Bardoxolone induces NRF2, a transcription factor with hundreds of target genes that promotes normal mitochondrial function and reduces pro-inflammatory signaling pathways and cytokine production. Mitochondrial dysfunction and chronic inflammation are key pathogenic features of many diseases, and our drugs have many potential applications. As you know, many of you know, we're currently conducting 8 clinical programs in rare, severe, and life-threatening diseases. In each case, a key feature of the target disease is mitochondrial dysfunction driving an inflammatory and fibrotic phenotype in diseases that otherwise may seem unrelated. During October, we announced updated positive phase 2 data from Lariat, our study of patients with pulmonary arterial hypertension, and we launched Catalyst, a phase 3 study of bardoxolone in patients with pulmonary arterial hypertension caused by their scleroderma, lupus, and other forms of autoimmune disease. In addition to the phase 3 study, we're surveying for activity in 4 subtypes of pulmonary hypertension caused by interstitial lung disease. We're also conducting 3 phase 2 studies of omaviloxolone, a closely related analog of bardoxolone. OMAV is being tested as a treatment for Friedreich's ataxia, mitochondrial myopathy, and cancer. The Friedreich's ataxia and mitochondrial myopathy are genetic mitochondrial diseases. Our immune oncology program is attempting to use our pharmacology to unmask tumors from the immune system by suppressing production of reactive oxygen and nitrogen species that tumors release to escape detection by T cells. An important recent development that led us to Alports was that our Asian development partner, Kiowa Hako Kirin, announced interim results from their phase 2 study of patients with moderate CKD from diabetes. In their study, they used the gold standard technique called the inulin clearance method to directly measure changes in GFR in response to bardoxolone. This is a difficult technique in which an inert tracer is used to directly measure GFR. The study definitively showed that bardoxolone produced significant improvements in measured GFR. The Kirin data also validated our renal improvement data in 6 prior clinical studies of bardoxolone in diabetic CKD patients. As many of you know, we enrolled over 2,600 patients in clinical studies that culminated in a large phase 3 study called Beacon. As Colin will discuss in more detail, in these studies, we consistently observed that bardoxolone methyl treatment increased estimated GFR and creatinine clearance, significantly reduced uremic solutes like BUN and uric acid, and it numerically reduced renal serious adverse events and dialysis events. We terminated the development program in diabetic CKD in 2012 when we stopped Beacon for a safety signal that we did not understand at the time, but that turned out to be manageable. After stopping the study, we discovered that patients with advanced CKD, a history of heart failure, and who had fluid overload and were in or near heart failure at baseline before receiving drug were at risk of retaining additional fluid only during the first 4 weeks on drug. All of our follow-on development programs have excluded patients at risk for fluid retention and have carefully monitored for this effect. There's been no fluid retention risk observed in our PAH programs or Kirin's diabetic CKD program. We recently completed an end of phase 2 interaction with the FDA and initiated the Catalyst phase 3 study incorporating these risk management techniques. The new findings by Kirin, and in particular, the validation of the renal function improvements observed in our prior diabetic CKD studies, suggested that we should take the opportunity to utilize our CKD experience in an orphan renal disease like Alport syndrome. Since many of you may not be familiar with Alport syndrome, I'm going to take a moment to touch on some of the important aspects of the disease. Alport is a hereditary disease caused by a mutation in one of several genes encoding type 4 collagen. This leads to defects in the glomerular basement membrane in the kidney that cause significant leakage of protein into the tubules. Over time, Alport syndrome patients develop overt hematuria and proteinuria and have a progressive loss of kidney function. Approximately 12,000 patients in the U.S. and about 40,000 worldwide are diagnosed with Alport syndrome, and of these, roughly half will progress to dialysis or transplant events by the age of 25. Life expectancy of Alport patients is only 55 years. There's no therapies currently approved for Alport syndrome. ACE inhibitors and angiotensin receptor blockers are commonly used off-label, but despite their use, dialysis or renal transplant is required in most patients. Like other forms of CKD, excessive reabsorption of protein in the tubules induces chronic inflammation and fibrosis in the renal interstitium in these patients. This is similar to the effect of hyperglycemia and hypertension in other forms of CKD. In all of these cases, the chronic inflammatory processes lead to chronic declines in GFR. As the table illustrates, bardoxolin methyl and related analogs have been shown to improve renal function, reduce inflammation, and prevent injury, remodeling, and fibrosis in many animal models of renal injury and disease. Our compounds have shown activity in models of hypertension, diabetes, lupus, and most importantly, models of CKD caused by protein overload that are directly relevant to Alport syndrome. With that background, I'm now going to turn it over to Reata's Chief Medical Officer, Colin Meyer, to discuss the effects in our prior CKD studies and the design of the pivotal Phase 2-3 trial on Alport syndrome.
Thanks, Warren. As Warren mentioned, we have observed activity in a broad number of preclinical models of renal disease, and this activity has translated to patients with renal impairment from several etiologies. Bardoxolin methyl initially demonstrated improvements in kidney function in cancer patients, and we have also observed improvements in patients with PAH. These trials primarily enrolled patients with mild impairment of kidney function. The largest body of clinical evidence showing improvements in renal function is from 7 studies of patients with CKD caused by type 2 diabetes that enrolled approximately 2,600 patients. These trials showed statistically significant improvements in kidney function in patients with moderate to severe renal disease. The magnitude of change was on average between 6 to 9 mL per minute, which represents at least 2, if not several years of disease progression. As Warren mentioned, the most recent data were generated by our commercialization partner in Asia, Kirin, which validates estimated GFR as a clinical endpoint for measuring improvement in renal function from bardoxolin methyl treatment. An important finding from our prior CKD development is that the improvements in kidney function are durable for at least 1 year, the longest duration tested. The BEAM and BEACON trials included approximately 600 patients who were on study for approximately 1 year, 400 of which received bardoxolin methyl. In BEAM, patients at the 2 highest dose levels showed improvements as early as 1 month after randomization that further increased in magnitude through 1 year of treatment. The mean kidney function at baseline for these patients was approximately 32 mL per minute, and on average, patients in these 2 groups had increases of approximately 15 to 16 mL per minute, which represents approximately a 50% increase in kidney function. In BEACON, patients had stage 4 CKD and very low kidney function at baseline, but were able to demonstrate large increases of approximately 30% from both baseline and placebo that were durable. Patients who received bardoxolin methyl experienced numerically fewer renal serious adverse events and dialysis events than placebo patients. As Warren mentioned earlier, bardoxolin methyl has demonstrated antifibrotic activity in multiple preclinical models, which translated to improved renal function. We have investigated bardoxolin methyl's potential to demonstrate disease-modifying activity in both BEAM and BEACON. Subtherapeutic concentrations of drug are achieved within approximately 10 days after drug withdrawal, and there are no active metabolites. In these studies, we assess kidney function 4 weeks after drug withdrawal, which was approximately 3 weeks after all pharmacologic activity of bardoxolin methyl was gone. We observed a significant improvement relative to placebo at the mid and high dose in BEAM, as well as in BEACON. The sustained increase in kidney function through 1 year of treatment and the presence of a sustained kidney function improvement after withdrawal of drug suggests that remodeling and fibrosis that contribute to declining kidney function may be improved over the course of longer-term treatment with bardoxolin methyl. As Warren mentioned earlier, we have received clear guidance from FDA about the requirements for approval of bardoxolin methyl and Alport syndrome, which will require only a single pivotal trial. We have designed the trial in collaboration with international key opinion leaders and the Alport Syndrome Foundation. Many of the key elements of the trial have been decided and we're in the process of finalizing the protocol. Together, we have designed this trial to include a phase 2 cohort and a phase 3 cohort under one clinical protocol to expedite development. The eligibility criteria for the trial are broad, and we will enroll patients who are from 12 to 60 years old. We will enroll patients with kidney function between 30 to 90 mL per minute, but will exclude patients with stage 4 CKD. We will also exclude patients with significant cardiovascular disease or fluid retention. The phase 2 cohort will be open label and enroll 30 patients, 15 with macroalbuminuria and 15 with microalbuminuria. The primary endpoint for this portion of the trial will be the change in kidney function at week 12, but patients will be followed for a total of 2 years. We are conducting this cohort to determine whether the activity observed in other settings of CKD translates to Alport syndrome. We will also use these data to adjust and optimize the design of the phase 3 cohort, if necessary. We expect to begin enrolling patients into the phase 2 cohort in the first half of next year, and will provide guidance as to data availability once we announce initiation of the trial. The phase 3 cohort will support registration and will be double-blinded and placebo-controlled. We will enroll up to 180 patients randomized evenly to drug or placebo, and these patients will be followed for a total of 2 years. As shown in the diagram at the bottom of this slide, patients will be titrated from 5 milligrams to a final dose between 20 milligrams and 30 milligrams, given orally once daily. The phase 3 primary efficacy endpoint with the change from baseline in estimated GFR in bardoxlimethyl-treated patients relative to placebo after 48 weeks. The estimated GFR change will be measured while the patients are on treatment, and the key secondary endpoint will be the change from baseline in estimated GFR after withdrawal of drug for 4 weeks later, at week 52. After the initial withdrawal, patients will be restarted on study drug with their original treatment assignments and will continue on study drug for a second year. Based on FDA guidance, if the trial is positive, the year one off-treatment data could support accelerated approval, and the year two off-treatment data could support full approval. While our past CKD results don't necessarily predict what may occur in new indications, we believe they are instructive for us to design and model the upcoming phase 2-3 trial in Alport syndrome. First, it's important to note that we have data from 7 CKD trials that enrolled over 2,600 patients, and 2 of these trials included 600 patients with approximately 1 year of follow-up. We have gained insights into baseline characteristics and other factors that predict response to treatment, including baseline estimated GFR, proteinuria, as well as the dose range that is associated with durable activity. From a safety perspective, outside of a small subset of identifiable patients in the Beacon trial that developed overt fluid retention, bardoxlimethyl has generally been safe and well tolerated. We have thoroughly investigated the findings in the Beacon trial, have discussed them with regulators, published them in the literature, and we and our Japanese partner have been able to avoid this finding in our ongoing PAH and CKD trials by excluding at-risk patients and closely monitoring them after enrollment. We will use the same approach in our Alport syndrome trial to maintain patient safety. Our titration dosing approach should allow investigators freedom to actively manage any unforeseen adverse events or tolerability issues. We have designed the Alport syndrome trial to be able to replicate the findings of the BEAM trial, which showed a clinically meaningful and statistically significant placebo-corrected improvement in kidney function 4 weeks after withdrawal after 1 year of treatment. The mid-dose and placebo included 90 patients. To provide a conservative margin, we are planning to enroll double this number, or 180 patients, which will allow us to detect a placebo-corrected difference that is approximately half of what we observed in BEAM while demonstrating statistical significance. Based on bardoxolone's extensive development history that has shown improvements in renal function across many studies in a range of patients, including diabetic CKD, the similarity of the pathophysiology of Alport syndrome to diabetic CKD, and the retained treatment benefit demonstrated by bardoxolone in 2 independent studies, we have confidence in the design of our study and that bardoxolone may be the first therapy approved for patients with Alport syndrome. With that, I'll turn it back over to Warren for closing remarks.
Thanks, Colin. To sum up, we're delighted to announce our new development program in Alport syndrome. We're adding it to a robust portfolio of development opportunities. As you can see here, we're expecting to have a number of clinical readouts upcoming in calendar 2017, followed by pivotal data from our Catalyst trial in the first half of 2018. So we look forward to continuing to keep you up to date as our programs make progress. And at this point, I'd be delighted to take any questions. Candace, why don't we begin the Q&A process?
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen on the phone lines, if you would like to ask a question at this time, please press star followed by the number one key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, you may press the pound key. And our first question comes from Charles Duncan of Piper Jaffray. Your line is now open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the question, and I really like to continue to focus on rare and orphan diseases with Bardoxil and your pipeline. My question is regarding the patient population or the characteristics for Alport syndrome. Colin kind of addressed this towards the end of his prepared remarks. But in addition to the etiology, how would you compare the disease in terms of severity or some other characteristics that you would consider when thinking about the predictive value of Bardoxolone's previous clinical data in CKD?
Thanks, Charles. I guess I make two comments. First of all, these patients who have Alport syndrome typically do not have the cardiovascular disease that the diabetic CKD patients have. And so their cardiovascular comorbidities are reduced and their cardiovascular endpoints are therefore occur at much lower frequency. However, from a renal perspective, they actually progress at about the same rate as diabetic CKD patients. And most patients need dialysis or renal transplant in their lifetime. And the most common form that affects young boys typically strikes them when they're in their early teens to basically 8 years of age or so. And so those patients, about half of them, will need renal replacement therapy by age of 25, and approximately 90% will need dialysis by the time that they're 40 years of age. And so from a renal perspective, the pathophysiology is similar, the rate of progression is similar, and the unmet need is similar.
Hi, Charles. This is Warren. I'll just add slightly to that. And, from a pathophysiology standpoint, while here the cause of the disease is a genetic defect, which, causes structural leakage of protein, when you look at the effects of the leakage of protein, it's similar to the effects in other forms of CKD where the inflammatory stimulus might be excessive, hyperglycemia, in diabetic patients or hypertension in patients with cardiovascular disease. Those activate inflammatory pathways. And in the case of the Alport's patients, it's the protein uptake that activates the inflammatory pathways. And this is really quite similar. As you know, our pharmacology is to intervene to try to resolve the inflammation really without regard to what the initial stimulus is.
Yeah, that's very helpful. And if I could just slip in one quick financial one, I'm wondering, in terms of the impact on R&D spend over the course of, say, the next 12 to 18 months, I know you're probably not prepared to give formal guidance, but how do you see that? And then could you just remind us on with regard to the partnership with AbbVie, do they have opt-in rights for this indication or any other rights?
Yeah, I'll take the second part of that first. And yes, they do have, similar to PAH, they have an opt-in right for the commercialization rights outside of the U.S. and outside of the Kiowa-Hako-Kirin territories. Kirin also has opt-in rights in Japan and Southeast Asia, and they're both evaluating the opportunity.
Well,
I don't
US,
think we're prepared. Yeah, but we own 100% of the economic rights in the U.S. for this, as well as we receive royalties from the offshore sales in all territories.
Sure.
And yeah, we're not really we haven't finalized the design of this study, so we don't we're not really going to provide any guidance in terms of the R&D spend here. I will say these are not relatively expensive studies. If we went forward with the full development program, I'm guessing it would be less than, for example, our PAH phase 3 study.
Okay, that's helpful. Thanks for taking the questions.
Thanks.
Thank you. And our next question comes from Ritu Baral of Cowen. Your line is now open.
Hi, guys. Thanks for taking the question. I wanted to focus first on the requirements for what the FDA would consider a successful trial. So on slide 11, you said the primary endpoint was on treatment change at week 48 and, you know, just generally backing into the powering that Colin mentioned, and you're anticipating 50% of what you saw before, so maybe 2.5 to 3 points on the eGFR. But then you mentioned that success would be off-treatment effect. Does that mean you have to reach the primary endpoint and the key secondary endpoint for the FDA to regard this phase 3 portion as successful?
That is correct.
Okay. Should the key secondary not hit for any reason, are there other any of the other secondary endpoints that would be as meaningful or close to as meaningful to FDA?
I think they'll have to review the data, you know, once they're available. So obviously the year 2 data will be important for them. So with successful year 2 data, that would support, you know, full approval of the drug.
Okay, so if you don't hit the hurdles at the subpart H 1 year, you would still have the trial continue, and you might be able to reassess at 2 years. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay. And then on the powering, again, I just wanted to go over what FDA may have said was sort of the acceptable level of benefit. You're powering this to show half of what was observed at Beam, and so that's 2.5, and you mentioned that the rate of progression was about the same. So that's about, I guess, 1 year's worth of progression. Is that clinically meaningful to the agency? Do you have that in writing?
And so I think the FDA generally does not comment, you know, on the specific, you know, treatment delta that they would like to see. They commented to us that they would like to see a significant, you know, separation between drug and placebo, you know, at the week 52 time point. And so we think that, you know, approximately 2.5 GFR points, you know, is clinically meaningful and would be acceptable to them.
Got it. And then just a couple questions on the phase 2 portion. Are the doses in the phase 2 portion the same as in the phase 3 as outlined on slide 11? And what is driving your separation between the micro and the macro in the phase 2? What do you hope that will tell you?
Okay, so to answer your first question, the only difference between the phase 2 portion and the phase 3 is that they're an independent set of patients. And so the phase 2 portion will enroll 30 patients, all on active drug, and will be followed for the same duration using the same titration scheme. And those data, you know, will allow us to see if the effects that we've seen in other patient populations translates into Alport syndrome. As you can appreciate, there's, you know, many factors that could influence a response to treatment, and one key factor is the amount of proteinuria that patients have at baseline, and that's indicative of the, you know, underlying, you know, defect they have to their kidneys and likely the amount of irreversible damage. And so we want to look at a range of patients to see the treatment effect, and then we could potentially use that to adjust the patient mix in the phase 3 portion or the sample size if necessary. We want to make sure that we see activity across the spectrum of patients who will be enrolled.
Understood. And last super quick question, the eGFR range that you're enrolling, does that to you in this disease represent sort of moderate or mild or severe disease in your opinion?
Probably moderate. And so from the discussions that we've had, obviously, with FDA, they agreed, you know, with the range of 30 to 90, which is quite broad. And when we've discussed the range with key opinion leaders, they've noted that if a patient, you know, has a loss of kidney function to below, you know, 90 GFR points, that patient is likely at risk of reaching, you know, dialysis, you know, in their lifetime. And so it does represent the at-risk patient population.
Hi, Ritu, this is Warren. I'll just add one thing to that, too. And one, I think, positive aspect of this study is we will have the opportunity to bend the progression curve in these patients. We're able to, we specifically ask for guidance on how early we could treat, and you know, we have clearance to treat patients as young as 12 years old in the study. So we have an opportunity to catch them earlier with less severe disease and then bend the rate of their progression.
Great. Thanks for taking all the questions, guys. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And as a reminder, ladies and gentlemen, to ask a question at this time, please press star 1. And I'm showing no further questions at this time. I'd like to turn the conference back over to Vinny Jindal for closing remarks.
Thanks, Candace, and excuse me, and thanks to everyone who participated on the call today. We look forward to speaking to you again soon. Thanks.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for participating in today's conference. This does conclude the program. As a reminder, a downloadable PDF of today's presentation and an audio recording will be available shortly after this conference call on Reata's website at Reata Pharma in the Investor News section shortly after the call today. Have a great day, everyone.